Okay, we're going to get started on the panel on direct democracy in the US and beyond. Our speakers are David Van Dusen, who has led a successful effort to democratize Vermont AFL-CIO State Labor Council and initiated steps to strengthen Vermont's town meeting tradition. And Marina Citrin, an author of the forthcoming We Make Our Own Justice, Global Alternatives to Policing and Prisons. Okay, so the way we're going to do this panel, we're going to start with a short interactive exercise, and then we'll have a discussion, and the speakers will, you'll hear from the speakers.
Okay, I'm gonna have us start doing something interactive. So those people who are in this area, or if you wanna come over and do this, it'll be fun, it'll be about 5 minutes. We're gonna break into groups of like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 1, 2, 3, and whoever comes to join you. Okay, in each of your groups, you're gonna have 5 minutes to order a pizza. That's all, you have to order a pizza together. Pretend we're actually going to order it. Pretend you're all going to eat because you're hungry. So figure out what kind of pizza you're gonna order here. You can't do more than half and half, just as a thing, but you can have a really creative pizza bakery. So they can do all kinds of creative things with the dough and the cheese and the whatever. Okay, so would you join this group over here? And when you go, introduce yourselves to each other. If you all know each other in one group and you don't in the other, ideally you'd like mix it up, but, okay, 5 minutes to pizza. So can you describe your pizza and how you got it?
The whole thing is vegan cheese because everybody there was okay with vegan cheese. It has really thick crust because I don't like pizza, so I just eat the crust. And I think that's pretty much it. It's just like a vegan cheese pizza with a really thick crust.
Was it hard to get to the decision?
Everybody's pretty amicable and really flexible, but I think that's the benefit. You know, obviously a lot of people at an anarchist book fair are going to be okay with veganism and vegan options. So there was no argument like, oh, I want meat, you know. So I think we definitely had that on our side.
We had meat on our pizza. All right, we'll talk about that though. Somebody else from the next group, same thing. If you played a large role taking notes, the other person.
Ours, again, was a very, very easy and I would say very amicable process. We ordered for a veggie pizza and mushroom and onion topping.
Did anyone want something different?
No, everybody was really flexible and accommodating.
Y'all stink. Okay, so maybe this one having the vegans was a little more complicated, or maybe ours was because there's like meat eaters, I'm not a meat eater, extra cheese, not spicy, I wanted jalapenos. And so we can talk about our process. But so what did it feel like to make your pizza?
Well, I'll just speak for myself. I was the vegan and I was, normally I am met with eye rolling and hesitation. People are like, ugh, vegan cheese. So in the beginning, I think we all said our limitations or preferences, and it seemed daunting in the beginning because we were like, oh, well, I don't even like pizza, you know, or I don't eat meat, I'm vegan, da da da. And it did end up working out, but in the beginning, I think we were, or at least I felt a little apprehensive that all of our preferences might not mull together as well as they did, so I was pleasantly surprised by that.
Very nice. How about over here? I know you all got along, but there must have been some. Was there apprehension in the beginning? Yeah, okay, so now we're getting at the meeting. This is so weird to do with the microphone, no? Should we just shout it out? But that is actually like, oh, you all were so easy, and that's good, and then the pizza's going to come, and maybe you're going to be like, this is not what I wanted at all, and the crust, and what's it made out of, and ew, cheese. But you all agreed with each other because you were all being really nice, and that's a thing, but there's a lesson there.
The lesson is that we just didn't really care that much. So maybe if it were something that we really cared about, the stakes would actually be higher. You know, like we're like pizza, whatever. But like make a decision about like a real life event, then it's like, oh, wait, all these things come up. So
Okay, next time you won't have eaten for 3 days. And then it's going to like, then we've got steaks. Okay, well, we'll figure this out next time. But so the whole, like, this seems like it's going to be daunting. It actually wasn't very daunting, and it probably wasn't even 5 minutes, and you figured out a pizza that, like, it wasn't perfect. Is it perfect? You don't even like pizza. So how is this perfect? This is what you have to eat. But I'm okay with it, right? So what is this? What are we talking about here? Consensus. So it's like, it's not going to be perfect, but you're going to be okay with it. You all had to be more hungry. We had to, like, you're okay with everything. Neither of us are going to be thrilled with the pizza. But we're going to manage it. And that's kind of the point of this exercise, and to kind of get us started talking about different forms of direct democracy, and consensus being one. How do we make decisions together in a way where we're listening to each other? And you weren't really going to order a pizza if, like, you say I'm vegan and everyone else says, too bad you're eating meat. But even if it weren't at an anarchist book fair, I've done these exercises at, like, all over. It's not mine originally, but, like, it's, no, people aren't going to make somebody else eat something they're allergic to that makes them sick, that repulses, whatever, right? We're going to find a way to listen to each other pretty quickly and come up with a decision, or not pay enough attention to it and all get a mediocre pizza. Which is, I mean, that maybe is somewhere we want to go in the conversation, actually, is like, if we're not actively participating in the process, what does that mean as far as the outcome?
Yeah, so before we come back to, you know, the more concrete practices, maybe we can hear a little bit about some local and not local practices of direct democracy, and especially experiences of those practices. So we'll go to David first and then Marina.
My name is David Van Dusen. I recently served 2 terms as president of the Vermont AFL-CIO. But I say Vermont for a reason, because we don't have to point to a place in the distant past or for 30 days around the Paris Commune in 1871 or all the way to Rojava today to find places where forms of direct democracy are actually practiced. So where I live in Vermont, it's a bit of an anomaly, where actually I think it's unprecedented in the rest of the United States, where there are 2 layers of government throughout the state. There's the state government in the capital, and then there is every single municipality where the normal process is. There's some nuance to it, but the normal process is that all the citizens together in a community constitute the legislative branch of government. And local decisions are made at town meeting. And some of those town meetings can be 12 hours long. They're not easy. It's not as easy as getting a half-assed pizza that, you know, isn't necessarily what anybody wanted, but it was the lowest common denominator. I mean, you want to pull your hair out sometimes at town meeting. But when people are empowered to make real decisions, not symbolic decisions, but real decisions, then they understand, this is at least what I find, that their view matters. And when their view matters, they're more apt to take part in community building events, in politics, have an opinion about all sorts of issues. Now, when I said that in part it is a direct democracy, it is only in part. It is partial. That direct democracy in Vermont is empowered to make decisions on the local level. Shall we buy a new snowplow truck? What will the uses of the town forest be, or should we purchase a communally owned town forest, which is very common where I live? These are local decisions. What we do not have now is a system where that power in aggregate can reach up in a binding way to impact the political systems and decisions and social benefits that the state as a whole has a responsibility for. But where there is a kernel or a start, I believe that there could be progress and there could be a movement to expand those forms of democracy. There's a lot more nuance to that than all this than what I'm saying, but just as a brief overview, that's where I come from. And of course, democratizing our institutions or our bodies, our representative bodies, our places like our labor unions has to be part of this too, because if we're gonna fight to democratize society as a whole and communities, we also have to democratize, make sure we're democratizing our unions and those bodies that are gonna fight for an expanded direct democracy.
I think I'd rather actually go to comments and conversation, because it seems like a lot of people have a lot of experience from different places. So conversations about municipalism, about global movements that are directly democratic and horizontal. I have a question, but we can also try to talk about it together, which is, it's surprising me that more recently some groups are organizing, activist groups, movement groups, that aren't very directly democratic. Because my experience, you know, from like high school where there's Robert's Rules of Order and like all this hierarchy, and then with the Zapatista movement, 1994, the Global Justice movement, 1999, there was a huge wave of direct democracy as a part of the direct action, as our process. And I had the sense that that was continuing in movement spaces, in so many movement spaces. And I'm also getting the sense that more recently, that's more mixed. And so my question would be, is that really true, that it's more mixed, that there's kind of hierarchy coming into some radical spaces? And if there is, and you're someone who's a proponent of more directly democratic spaces, how can you think about, how do we help make that shift? That would be one question. There's a whole other question, which is like, we call ourselves directly democratic and then we're not, and how do we deal with that? But yeah, I don't know if we want to open it up, because you all have so much more experience. It feels really weird to be sitting here with the microphone. I mean, I have experience collecting stories around the world and participating, but so did all of you. So
my question, maybe then we'll open up to some comments like from both of you. I mean, Marina, you talked about the practices of consensus making, right? Or consensus building, right? David, you mentioned, decision making. The question was about participation from Shams. You know, so if you could both, you know, talk a little bit, like, what is direct democracy, right? What are the basic components? What are the basic practices, right? What practices constitute direct democracy?
I'm not going to give a definition, but from experiences, you know, from experience, it is about, like, when you're ordering the pizza, it's every person's voice matters, and we need to find ways to make sure all of our voices are heard, and in a meaningful, deep way, not the, like, bad pizza. So if I was facilitating in there, I would probably, as a facilitator, try to get a little deeper to figure out, like, okay, let's really make sure this is meaningful so that we each have meaningful participation. And whatever that means. So in different contexts, that's going to mean different things. And in some places, that will mean consensus, like you choose to kind of go to the lowest common denominator. And in other places, that might mean going to a vote. It doesn't necessarily mean you use one form or another, but it means that decisions are made collectively by everyone. And there are different kinds of structures that you can use for that, like the municipalism in Vermont. There can be, you know, this, the example of the Zapatistas and how you have kind of many different communities. There's often different kinds of leadership, but without it being hierarchical leadership. So people who are playing like spokespeople type roles, and then they're accountable back to the group as a whole, and they're rotating always. And the Zapatistas, they rotate so much that sometimes people think that can be really challenging to have so much rotating leadership, but it's also about teaching everyone. We are all leaders in the process. So that's my beginning. We can keep talking about it, though.
So to touch on some of that, I would say that direct participatory democracy needs to, to kind of restate the obvious, mean participation. It doesn't mean hiding behind a voting booth with a curtain down and every so often pulling a lever, yes or no. That is not participatory. And electing people is not, of course, direct. So when we talk about a town meeting system, or more importantly, when we look at a revolution that is real, that is fighting with arms right now to advance these ideas, direct democracy, like we see in Rojava, you know, we need to understand that the vision is for all people in that society to have a place to stand up, to speak their minds, to argue their points with their neighbors, with their friends, with people they don't know who have a common stake in what the issue is. And at the end of the day, for there to be a binding decision-making process that comes directly from people looking in each other's eyes, right? And I think that keeps things civil, more civil too, when it's participatory. Those are far-reaching ideas, but they are not new ideas. These have been around for hundreds, if not thousands of years. So that's my way of not giving a definition. But at the same time, I think that we would all, if we're sitting here at an anarchist book fair, recognize that the vestiges of representational democracy we have in the United States today is not enough. and it is hardly, it is becoming a stretch to call it any form of democracy.
I don't think it's democracy.
Fair enough.
Yeah, I mean, I think that if we're not participating and our voice is actually not meaningfully heard, like the pizza's being ordered for us and we're told to eat it, and you might have a few options, but if you're vegan, sorry. If you don't like pizza, well, that's too bad too, right? I mean, that's, so these alternative forms and then how people are practicing them in different spaces seems incredibly important. How we manifest that. And then like there's some nuts and bolts that we can talk about too that I think are really important. Like in each of these spaces, I think you all were social and getting to know each other. And over here, there's like one person speaking a little more to like help gather everybody's information, right? Who is that? Were you doing that more? And that's kind of like a facilitator, right? That's the role of like a facilitator ideally. You know, we'd have a team of that, but it doesn't just like magically, oh, we're all gonna hear each other's voice equally and in the same amount. But someone plays a role to make sure, you know, you're both introducing and facilitating in that like, okay, if I'm talking too much, you're gonna gently take the mic, but we're also gonna make sure everybody's voice can be heard as much as possible. And that role can't be underestimated. And I think too often we just assume, oh, I'll facilitate without actually doing workshops and trainings and spending a whole lot of time to really learn and practice and feel good about how we can help bring forward different people's voices, and that we all are different in our experiences and how we want to talk, and a lot of us don't want to talk, so how do we make that happen? We can also talk about context too, like making the town meetings more fun. I bet you have food sometimes. If we're talking about our movements and not reorganizing society as a whole, but we can link them because I think a lot of us are very prefigurative in the way we're thinking, so what we're doing now is about the future we're creating, like right here, right now. There's a friend here from the days back in like Global Justice Movement, Direct Action Network. You were part of the Global Justice Movement as well. And even before that in the anti-nuclear movements, there are a lot of skills that people have. And we used to do so many workshops and trainings and workshops and training. And you train people to be trainers and you train those trainers to, you know, like it on and on and on and on. And I think that's something we need to be doing more because that got passed on actually literally with human beings. And then when we had the Occupy Wall Street movement, a lot of us who are in the global justice movement played a role in, you know, often kind of more background doing these same trainings in legal, keeping each other safe, in, you know, having medical teams set up, self-defense on and off, de-escalation or an alternative, and facilitation. Like, that's huge. So we have to have more skill sharing of that and then making sure more and more people can do it and doing it in teams. Like, that's really also key to not just have the one person doing it. And it's like the each one teach one civil rights movement slogan. Yeah.
So the questions about how to make people care beyond passive participation and passive caring. Yeah.
I recall, was it John Dewey, a Vermonter, said something along the lines of the only solution to the problems of democracy is more democracy. In my experience, when an issue comes up, if people don't feel empowered, like they have a means to actually impact the decision, they are going to be passive, often. The hope is a key ingredient, is an essential ingredient of change. There needs to be a sense of hope, but that sense of hope needs to be linked with a realistic, something that somebody could imagine really happening, process by which power can be taken away from the systems that exist now and placed into a body where individuals or collectively can exert their opinion or their influence. One of the problems we have in Vermont is the local democracy, the direct democracy, is limited to those local issues. So poll after poll will tell you that the majority of Vermonters support single-payer healthcare or livable wages or things along these lines. Yet year in, year out, the representational democracy at the state level does not enact those things. So with the Vermont AFL-CIO, what we have made part of our 10-point program, we call it the Little Green Book, is we're committed to fight for a constitutional change in the Vermont state constitution that would create an empowered town meeting-like system whereby laws or social programs or principles can be adopted if and when a majority of the towns representing a majority of the people, express their views that this will be such. It's our view. It's not my view. It is my view, but it's not just my view. It's the view of the Vermont AFL-CIO that if we're able to get this passed, if we're able to get this to happen, we will see town meeting participation double overnight. And town meeting is not just once a year. You could call for a town meeting as you feel necessary in a community. So what interests me is not just how do we practice, it's important, but not just how do we practice a form of direct democracy within the groups that we are in that is trying to create democratic change society. What interests me in a bigger way is what is that democratic site and how are we going to get to it? And if the answer is someday there's going to be a revolution and then I'm not even listening to you at that point. What concrete steps are we going to take now to organize towards and have measurable goals along the way of fighting for that democratization? Because as we wait, we see what vestiges we have of democracy slipping away rapidly, especially in the South and Republican-controlled states. So that's a concern.
I just want to kind of add to that as a part of that, and the what makes it real and concrete is also the what we're doing. So the self-organization, like the autonomy is kind of implicit in this, but then the self-organization and that they work back and forth as far as direct democracy and the more we're self-organizing and for something concrete. So it does not concrete demands, concrete something. So when there were, you know, in these encampments, a lot of the encampments, not all of them, but a lot of them are directly democratic. And you're organizing and making decisions all the time about food, about safety, about care, about infiltration, about all of these different kinds of decisions. And they're made, you know, so the concreteness also helps as a glue. And when there's not as much concreteness, I think it also falls to the side a little bit more. So the two have to go together. Also, just, and I don't know if we're going to talk about it or kind of go global, but this model, I don't know if you think about like municipalism or confederation as far as thinking about how what it's called in Vermont, but that's something that after the 15M movement, you know, the version in Spain before Occupy, some people in the assembly movement went into neighborhoods to continue organizing in neighborhoods. Some people went into workplaces and some moved into this Barcelona en Comun. So like a municipalism, but in the city of Barcelona. So taking it into the city and trying to flatten it, essentially, with decision making.
I'm just going to share our story. We have a mutual aid group that started in February of 2020 dealing with COVID, and it's grown and done a lot of work since then. And we tried very hard to make it non-hierarchical right from the start. We had meetings every single week. We did a consensus decision-making workshop. We trained everybody, but nobody really wanted to be a part of making those decisions. I don't know if it was fear or they just didn't feel that it was important for their voices to be heard. We did everything we could think of to try to get people to actually be a part of making the decisions. And it really didn't work very well. But one of our most recent projects that we've started doing is a food share that we do once a week. We get donated groceries and we deliver them to some people who are homebound. And we have a bunch of volunteers who help organize this who are also recipients of the food. So they're directly impacted by this food. And as we have been doing this, we come across challenges and questions every single week. We're still trying to figure out how to do it best. And when we ask the volunteers and the community members, they're starting to, because we ask them every week, they're starting to feel a lot more comfortable sharing their perspectives and making these decisions together. But it took like a year before it really started to, where they started to feel like they actually have a say. But now it's really beautiful to see these people who have never been listened to before, who usually go to the food pantries where they're interviewed and interrogated and then handed a bag of food. They don't even know what's in it. And now they get to choose how we organize our whole distribution, as well as what they're getting and how we go about it. And I just wanted to share that's been our experience. It's taken 4 years to figure out how to do consensus decision making and make it more horizontal. But if you keep at it, you can get there. Morris County, New Jersey.
It just makes me think, though, maybe when we're talking about consensus decision making, maybe the only way or the democratic organizing, maybe the only way to make it work is if they're physically doing it, right? Because no one wants to come to meetings and no one wants to talk. But if they physically have to, in this case, move the food or decide how much each person can get, it's like it's a physical manifestation of the theoretical. And I think sometimes, especially in radical organizing or mutual aid, we can get very theoretical and not action oriented. And It's the only thing that's worked.
I mean, like part of both your comments, right? You know, it's the flip side of the passive participation is like the question of patience, burnout. You know, it's like what practices and processes then, you know, can be.
I'm going to answer it with another question, which is, and it's something I was thinking about recently, you know, in the justice system in the Zapatista communities, everyone, adults, has to take a turn. This is one of the things that rotates really fast, like you're on it for, I think, only 2 weeks, and then somebody else, and they have councils, you know, a part of a kind of collective justice. But you have to. And so, like, ooh, you have to. It's autonomous. It's directly democratic. We have to. Can those go together? Could we imagine those like in the mutual aid networks or wherever, that if we are all a part of it, we all must take on some kind of role? Is that mutual? Is that exclusive then? Are we not being autonomous? Is that not direct democracy? Is it? So that's the question.
I don't think that there's one model, right, for any of this. It's largely a question of experimentation as well. So what's going to work for one group of folks or one community is not going to be, or I think it would be absurd to think it would be a one-size-fits-all for another community. But trying to experiment with these small groups, what I'm assuming is a relatively small group, trial and error, and trying to figure out what elicits action and participation and seeing what works. It might take a year, it might take 2 years, it might take time. The fact that you still exist, I think, is a testament that something's working. So that's a start. But I don't think there's a quick, easy answer for that.
I have noticed a trend towards your question of kind of hierarchical. I see it in groups that actually don't have analysis around anti-capitalist principles or anti-imperialism organizing. So I see that that's kind of what they gravitate to. But I also see that it can be people resort to that when they tend to feel very threatened or vulnerable, like when it feels like it's an attack. And I see that sometimes with issues around organizing around Palestine, like new stuff for people, like the youth who are just coming up can kind of resort to that as a this is what I know, this is what feels comfortable, because they might not have the background or seek education around those issues.
I've been thinking about that, the question that you initially posed, and about the tend to the, what's the word that I'm looking for, that these movement spaces tend to lean toward hierarchical situations. And I think just based on my personal experience in movement and in organizing spaces, it does seem that there is this default to look towards someone who is maybe the most charismatic, the most experienced, the loudest organizer. And it seems like even if there is a deliberate intention to democratize the space, I think people get nervous that they're going to miss out if, you know, we don't let the person with the most experience take the lead. And so I don't, it is working against the grain to do that. And I think it's tough because in movement spaces, we're working against the large grain, you know, we're fighting against the, you know, capitalism, racism, sexism, et cetera, et cetera. And then even within the spaces to even move against those micro grains of, no, let's intentionally listen to everyone and not just kind of default. Or if something happens in the space, right, and people don't know what to do, they sort of look toward one or a couple of people. And I think it's hard. I don't know if anyone has like tips or tricks or anything to make that easier to do or more intentional so that we don't default back into this hierarchical type of organizing space.
One thing I've seen also is not just these situations where inexperience leads to hierarchical practices because that's default, but also like, so it depends on what movement spaces you're talking about. There's a lot of different movement spaces we're representing here. When you're talking about protest movements, I found that there's this delicate dance that's being performed between being exclusionary on purpose so that we keep infiltration out and being exclusionary in a way that actually is not democratic. And if anyone has any tips on that, I'd love to hear them, because that is freaking hard. But But yeah, what you said about creating space, I think that one of the things that really helps movements that I've seen be successful is when the people who have the most experience deliberately step back at least at key moments, if not very frequently.
Just quickly to answer the other thing, as the ones that people default to as the leaders, we're always trying to figure out the answer to that question. And one thing is not just being really silent, giving them, you know, the space to do that. I'll also actually leave and make decisions together in a room without me. Like, we don't always have to be there. We can have the less experienced people be in a room working together. And then if they need, you know, suggestions or guidance later, they can. But if they brainstorm some initial ideas together, they start to feel more confident that their opinions actually, you know, matter too.
I think, like, the more tools we have for all of this, this to me is like also a tools question. So, like, can you have people break into smaller groups? And each smaller group has a different person than the one who facilitated the conversation, report back to the larger group, so it's the first time your voice might get heard. Like, little tools that you use so that more voices are heard, so that we go into smaller groups, so that, you know, we each have, yeah, more tools.
But the question still is, even if 500 small lefty groups in different corners of the world operated an amazing consensus-based direct democracy, what does that equal, right? I mean, the big question to me still is not just what are you doing in your people in your affinity group. The question is, how do you envision, and this is what I challenge you all with, how do you envision going from where we are right now as a society in the United States of America to one that starts to build more avenues of direct participatory democracy in society in a way that's empowered, not symbolic, not in your personal life, I'm saying politically and socially on a broader scheme. This is the issue, one of the issues and struggles that we in the Vermont AFL-CIO have been engaging in and trying to figure out, how do we grow that? How do we have a real plan? So perhaps in these small groups, and I say small because, you know, we haven't won the revolution yet, right? So I'm guessing they're pretty small. So how is it that your groups, yourselves, the people right here, how do you envision us getting from A to B? And how do you imagine the parts being more, you know, when we do our work together, and how do we get there? If anyone has any thoughts on that, that's what I'd love to hear from folks on.
Well, I mean, I definitely don't have an answer to that, but I think one thing that, if I could share an example from the anti-fracking movement in the area around Ithaca, something that we did early on with that was to recognize that a massive number of people were about to become involved with this because it was such a pressing issue. And so we tried to create a process that would allow the movement that emerged to be as decentralized as possible. So we had a weekly meeting that was essentially like a kind of like a spokes council. And we provided all the tools necessary for new groups to emerge. So rather than have a group that was kind of in charge of the movement to encourage as many groups as possible to emerge. So we had a whole range of resources of like literature on meeting facilitation and all the kind of nuts and bolts things. We had space, we had all of the kind of tools of it and what have you. And then we kept a master list of, it would be great if somebody would do this. And then just dozens and dozens of groups emerged out of that process without a kind of a central directing thing. And I think it was wildly successful because, I mean, it heavily contributed towards fracking being banned in the state. So I don't have an answer to that greater question, but I do think that there's a lot of power in intentionally setting things up so that they can be decentralized like that.
I do think that it's an and. And while we're thinking about this, while we're building towards this like broader dual power, however we're going to talk about it, everything we're doing in the building of our relationships matters. It's like muscle memory. We were having this conversation about muscle memory and like, oh, I haven't done this in a while, but boom, I know how to facilitate something because I've done it in the past. And there's going to be a moment maybe in your workplace where you're taking over your workplace and you're going to run it horizontally. And that activist group that you were a part of or that movement or that whatever will matter even more then. So we don't always know in the moment where it feels like maybe it's small, maybe it's hard, you left the room so that other people would make decisions. that may then be helpful later, like all of it. So it's the pitch for like whatever we're doing now, no matter how small, is incredibly important because there will be more and more moments. Not that we don't think about it. I mean, I'm absolutely, yes, think about it, create more structures for sure, and thinking about it and scaling over and feeling really good about how we're organizing right now.
I'm a little confused. So I oftentimes work with activist groups, but also using the arts. And so the question about envisioning futures is quite interesting to me. I'm also very influenced by folks, you know, who came from ACT UP, and you know, Sarah Schulman always talks about, you know, single issue, very simple questions, and that sort of makes it easy to make decisions and to achieve consensus in these groups. But when we run sort of arts workshops with people who are not in specific movements, and we do these speculative exercises in imagining futures, it's kind of shocking to what degree these futures are neocolonial, fascist, and discriminatory. So my question, I think, is about how we move from these practical situations where this, the issues are very simple, like, for example, with the encampment, right? Who gets the food, who gets, you know, certain things done, to scaling up, but also, yeah, imagining futures, you know, the exercises in these kind of, in political imagination.
So that reminds me, I'm going to get the quote wrong, but Jean-Paul Sartre said something along the lines of, the reason the worker doesn't rise up today in revolution is because they can't imagine being liberated. I've always thought, and I know I butchered that quote, but that, I've always found that one to be a very powerful notion. Now, I am definitely coming to that question from a very specific place, that being from within the labor movement. But, well, here's where it doubles back to the discussion about democratization within the subgroup. One of the reasons why I think you see in the labor movement over the last few decades, it's beginning to change, is a lack of vision, is because there's been a lack of democracy and there hasn't been avenues for working people to see their union as a vessel for an imaginative different kind of change. In Vermont, when we sought in 2019 to overthrow the old guard, which we did, and put leftists in positions of influence at all levels of the organization, we went and spoke with workers on the shop floor and heard from them from all around the state to start to compile a common vision. And once that common vision was encapsulated in a program, a platform, then we were able to get people excited about that, and they were able to recognize their own desires and their own ambitions collectively inside these goals that we put forward. And that helped us go from having a dead labor council with 20 people, 20 delegates representing 10,000 workers at a state convention, to well over 100 delegates coming from all over the state, representing a labor movement in our world, which essentially doubled AFL-CIO membership over those short amount of years. So democracy does matter, as you were saying. I think in order to help give folks the reason to start imagining something different.
And I think one of the things we can do is help to highlight where that vision already is in practice, and we might not even know. And I don't even just mean in like our activist group. I mean like with my neighbor who has children and I have a child, we will sometimes pick each other's children up if we need it. Or she'll take care of my dog and I take care of their snake, which I'm really loath to do, but okay. And that's like just pointing out like these little things that we do with each other and lending each other things. Like there are those moments that we see and they're small, but like if you're talking to someone who's not involved already and you begin to vision, it can help to just kind of think about that scale up, scale over, scale over, scale over, bigger. And to not underestimate again the like, when things sometimes pop up so much bigger and our experience mattering, I was thinking like, oh yeah, from the global justice movement to the Occupy movement, all of a sudden, some of us went from being in groups that, you know, had networks of thousands to in each city there were thousands of people. Or then there's Occupy Sandy, which, you know, people working around the hurricane. And then there's tens of thousands of people coordinating to help one another in a more horizontal way in the direct, you know, the mutual aid networks that came out around the pandemic. So that these examples of how we function in our day-to-day using, you know, kind of simple forms of direct democracy to meet each other's needs are already there. I think pointing them out to folks to then like, oh, well, what could that look like? How could we scale that over? What about that happening in your union rather than, you know, only in your neighborhood?
Just really quickly, I know that the world is fairly homogenous when it comes to capitalism, but not completely homogenous. If you have not already, I do encourage everybody here, if you haven't, to take a look and do some research what's going on in Northeast Syria and Rojava. And if anybody wants to be involved in that struggle here, doing solidarity work in the U.S., the Emergency Committee for Rojava, like there's flyers here, please pick one up and get involved.
And so we'll end it here, but with one more butchered quote. As someone once said, fascism will always have destruction on its side, but love belongs to democracy.